Anthony Salvantro is CBS News' Elections and Surveys Director. He's the person behind many of the poll numbers that you see today. In his new book, Where Did You Get This Number?, he takes readers on a tour inside the world of polling and shows you how to look at the numbers the way the pros do. He looks to uncover what's really driving polls and how to use them to see why people feel the way they do and where the country may be headed. His stories show that numbers are just a language and the tales they tell are really about people. Again, the name of the book is Where Did You Get This Number? A Pollster's Guide to Making Sense of the World. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and we welcome Anthony Salvantro to the roundtable this morning. Anthony, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you on the program. Before we talk about the book specifically, let me ask you, as we come out of the 2016 elections and look at what happened there, and as we are just a few months away from the fall midterms, what do you think the state of polling is right now?
I think it's just fine, to tell you the truth. But let me tell you why I think that. For one thing, let's be clear about what we ought to look at in the polls and what we shouldn't necessarily look at. Now, in 2016, a lot of folks have pointed out that the national polls were actually pretty accurate. And a lot of times when they say that or I say that, people kind of look at us funny. And they say, well, that's not what we expected. And I say, well, that's because, you know, the election was won and lost in the Electoral College. So you needed to look at some of those Midwest swing states. And quite frankly, I don't think there was enough polling there. Well, one of the lessons going forward is here in 2018, do polling that's concentrated in the seats, the House seats that could flip. Don't necessarily look at the national polls because Congress is a seat-by-seat race. So one of the things that we're doing now with our battleground tracker is going and polling very specifically in those races, hoping to tell you something about which way these races will really go. So again, it's you know, look at the places that are meaningful, look at the numbers that are meaningful. Whether or not they're accurate is a separate question. You want the ones that tell you what you want to know. And, you know, secondly, I do think sometimes we all get too wrapped up in the horse race and the idea that whoever's leading in the poll at, you know, even close to the election is always going to win. Remember that a campaign is an argument, that this is a dynamic. We pollsters watch this. We watch people vacillate. We watch people decide to show up or not show up, go back and forth between candidates sometimes. And, you know, if we allow that these are people we're talking to and that people are sometimes uncertain or undecided, well, we can see the race as much more dynamic rather than a foregone conclusion. That's one of the ways, one of the things I want to get across in this is how to look at all the polls can tell you, what they can tell you about that kind of dynamic, Joe.
If we are to get a poll from a contested, and let's say a hotly contested House race right now, at the end of August, prior to the November election, how meaningful is that for us in the media and for voters as well?
Well, if it's well done, then it's something that's meaningful today. But I would always ask, what can change? You know, look at a poll, almost like a campaign would, or a market research report, if you will, where we say, okay, well, where are the potential switches coming from? What voters might flip? Some of the dynamics we already see. We see the women's vote. We see moderate and even some Republican women, not in overwhelming numbers, but some, who say that they're uncertain what they'll do. They'll vote for a Republican this year, or if they're just unsure, or if they'll vote at all. You know, that's one of the things you say, okay, well, that's a potential dynamic. So let's see how the parties go after those voters. Let's see if they talk about the economy, about health care, about the things that they're concerned about. And that's one way to follow what's going to happen. So for any given district, you want to look at what the range of possibilities are. And, you know, one of the things we do too much sometimes is treat these all as foregone conclusions. You know, we don't want to look at a poll in August and say, well, that's a prediction of what happens in November. In some ways, it's much more powerful than that. It's actually your roadmap to all that people are thinking and doing and considering.
So as we look to the 2018 midterms and the polls that are coming out now, what do you make you personally make of the term blue wave?
Well, people can describe a wave as they wish. You know, I don't have a magic number in which I start to use a word wave or don't. And I think that's a matter of semantics. You know, the question is, really, if the question is House control, then the polling currently suggests that the Democrats are in position to gain seats and that they've improved that position over the summer, and that the total number of seats they gain while in question looks like it's about around where they would to take control. We have it at 222 right now. That's a little above the 218 that would lead them to take control, but it's within the margin of error. We put a 11-seat margin of error around that. So there are certainly scenarios right now in which the Republicans could hang on to the House. So, again, rather than treat that as a straight-up prediction, as forecast, which it is not, we say, okay, well, that's what's happening now. That's where people stand today. But what are they looking for, and what could change these things? And I think another one, frankly, is going to be who shows up. Now, midterms typically see, last time we saw 36% turnout, and sometimes around 40% of eligible voters showing up. So most people haven't. So what you've seen in the past year is we've seen reports of Democratic enthusiasm going up. We've seen special elections in which turnout's been high. And we have polls in which Democrats do tell us that they're by and large more enthusiastic about showing up than Republicans. Well, as a pollster, I ask, well, how much of a factor do I put that into my likely voter model? Some people show up even though they're not enthusiastic. Some people show up out of a sense of habit, a sense of duty. Or, you know, could the Republicans go and, you know, get their base more motivated and match those enthusiasm numbers? Those are all parts of the dynamics that I see happening right now.
You use the word semantics. I find it interesting because in these primaries that we're having and in some of the special elections, we're seeing, and I'm making this up completely, but in the third district of Iowa, in a clear rebuke to President Trump, this candidate won over that candidate. Can you really tell that from one district?
Well, it depends if there's any polling in it or not. You know, sometimes we all maybe make a lot out of, say, a vote pattern and associate that with a given precinct or a given county. But you have to be careful about the kinds of inferences that you make. You need to see a consistent pattern. And that's one of the things I caution, including in the book. You know, a pollster does not really look at any one given place and treat it as a bellwether. We look for patterns. Even on election night, if I see turnout is low in one key county, one important county, I say, okay, so I've gotten a measure of that. But then I'm going to look at other similar counties. I want to see one after another, in order to establish a pattern that turnout might be low, turnout might be high. That's one of the things that let us call the races in 2016. In fact, that's how it works. So, you know, applying that lesson forward to what we see now, we're doing the same thing with district by district. If I see one district in Iowa and then one district in Texas and one in California where we see a consistent pattern of counties, let's say, that voted for one party last time and appear to be voting for another county this time, well, then I start to establish something. Then I start to see something that I can believe. And that's one of the key lessons about being a pollster is looking for those kinds of patterns, Joe.
Anthony Salvanto is the author of Where Did You Get This Number? A Pollster's Guide to Making Sense of the World. So to that idea of where did you get this number, you have a great section in the book called Finding You. And it seems lately that whenever I know I do a segment on polling or talk about polls, that listeners will invariably bring up the issue of cell phones. So let us talk about that, because you talk about it quite a bit in that chapter and in the book, about how we get the people that we get when it comes to the polling information.
Love to. I often have people ask me, well, what about cell phones? And I always tell them, most of our interviews are completed on cell phones. And that's been true for years. I think going back maybe 10 or 12 years ago, it sort of got out there that Pollsters weren't doing that, but all good pollsters call, not just call cell phones, but call mostly cell phones. Now, look, polling has always gone, when it's done well, where Americans go. And obviously Americans use cell phones now, many only cell phones. So, of course, we do that. But I won't tell you, it hasn't made polling more expensive to do. People are harder to reach. People are busier. And so we have to dial more numbers today than we used to. And I think that increasingly puts, you know, the onus on the good pollster to keep dialing numbers and make sure that that sample looks like a microcosm of America, looks representative of America. And another way that we've changed is we do more and more polling online now. And so we put together representative samples, panels of people, again, creating that microcosm of the country in a small, in a sample. And we do the interview online because it's more convenient for people, or they find it private. They can take the questionnaire at their leisure. And, you know, we've been, in my view, very successful doing that. But again, it speaks a larger point that pollsters have always tried to innovate, always tried to move forward by going where Americans go. You know, we started out, polling started out going door to door. And so now people are online, so we'll go there. And that's part of the science in trying to put together that sample that reflects America, Joe.
Decades ago, if someone was having a baby, you didn't know it was 50-50, whether it was going to be male or female. We had no way of telling. Now we do. Well, is that better? I don't know. So in polling, is it good to know beforehand where we are?
Well, you know, I think it sets a context, but I do caution that we get too wrapped up in the forecasts and the horse race. And one of the things I say in the book is, you know, there are polling websites and there are polling aggregators where all of these polls, all these horse races are sort of combined into one big number. Here's who's up, here's who's down. And it can be tempting to only look at those and say, okay, well, my candidate's winning, we're done. But you can't imagine if you were a campaign that you would do that, because you would, you know, you wouldn't be out there trying to turn out voters. So people watching the poll shouldn't do that either. I think that you should look at any given poll and try to understand what people are truly saying and what issues they care about, and even try to understand, if it's a well-done poll, why the other side disagrees with you and what they're thinking. Maybe you can use that as a conversation starter. Maybe you can have a better discussion with somebody, maybe even persuade somebody. And that's what I mean by getting beyond the horse race. You know, we're not trying as pollsters to predict what you're going to think. We're trying to understand what you think now and why you think it. One of the fun parts about all of this is that as you talk to people or you see their responses, you start to see that people have different life experiences and different points of view, of course, but they're shaped by different experiences and by different kinds of circumstances. And it's up to us to try and understand them, to ask the right questions in order for people who've taken the poll to go, yeah, that's me, that's what I'm thinking, and then communicate that to the wider world. Ultimately, that's what we want to know. Ultimately, that's why we do polling, and that's why I hope people are interested in it. It's not just to forecast the future. We want to understand the world right now.
So as Director of Elections and Surveys for CBS News, when you see, let's go back to 2016, on Election Day at 12 noon Eastern Standard Time, and the New York Times has a poll up that says Hillary Clinton has, and I'm making this number up because I forget what it was, but say she has an 86% chance of winning the election. What impact does that have? Where does that information come from? And isn't that why sort of polling in general got a bad name? Because it seemed like those seem like pretty good odds, right?
Well, I'm really glad you raised that, and it underlines the big difference between a poll and a prediction, between a poll and a forecast. If somebody's out there on their website trying to tell you that there's odds of something happening or not happening, that is a very different kind of service. That's a very different kind of editorial than – it's a different product than what a poll is doing, right? A poll talks to people. A forecast does not. A poll interviews people and says, why are you thinking what you're thinking? You know, pollsters often like to be called survey researchers, emphasis on the survey. That is, we talk to people. And so I try to differentiate very much between the folks who put odds on things, and the folks who are trying to, you know, forecast the future, and the pollster who's out there talking to people and trying to understand you. They are different products. And
go ahead. Well, one of the things, and I am sorry to interrupt, but one of the things that I find interesting about that is that, isn't it, though, and at least we're often told this, that it is the poll or polls that are informing what that prediction is?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they use polls in their forecast models. And there, to that point, there isn't any question that Hillary Clinton did have a lead in a lot of those state polls, and that did move the forecasters. But what I emphasize is that number, that odds, two things happen. One is that oftentimes people misinterpret those percentages. Even the high percentages, they tend to kind of think yes or no, round it up to 100 or round it down to zero, and sort of discount the small but real possibilities of something happening. But the other point is, and this is more important, you know, in a poll, you can see the story beyond that top line. So even if, as it was the case in 2016, you had Hillary Clinton up in a lot of these places, you say, well, what could change? And the Republicans in those polls were telling you that they were at first not necessarily going to turn out for Donald Trump, but that they might. And so you see the range of possibilities in that. It's not surprising if conservatives ultimately decide to vote for candidate Trump and show up. The Democrats in those polls were also saying that they were not as enthusiastic as they were in, say, previous elections or as Republicans were. It might not be a surprise if they don't show up. And in fact, many did not. We saw turnout decline in a lot of high Democratic areas. So if you read the poll for the full story, you're much less surprised and you're much more aware of what's going on than if you just try to encapsulate it by one number or one percentage. You know, the single number like that, I always say, it doesn't tell you what's happening any more than the price of a bottle of wine tells you how good the wine will taste. It's one number that you think tells you the whole story, but oftentimes it does not.
You are a pollster, as I mentioned, director of elections and surveys. You know the science and what needs to be done. How does that, and does it ever, and I'm not saying in your particular case, but looking at who hires you impacts the way you do a poll?
Well, I can't speak directly to that. I'm a news pollster, so my job is to tell Americans what Americans are thinking. And that's often why I emphasize I'm reporting on the here and now. I'm not reporting from the future. I'm reporting and telling you what Americans are thinking and doing today. But, you know, as far as the science is concerned, I think one of the things I try to do in the book is explain in very plain language things that people ought to know, where your numbers come from. What is a margin of error anyway, and how do we explain when we say a race is within a couple of points? I want people to understand that, because oftentimes the margin of error, well, you know, there's a point at which things are undetermined, where we just can't be any more precise than we're being. Oftentimes, to use the margin of error example a little more, margin of error doesn't change a story. So if I say most people think the economy is good or very few people approve of Congress, well, if that approval number is, let's say, 15%, plus or minus 3 points, it doesn't change the story. So people sort of discount the margin of error and they say, well, you know, that's inconsequential. And so it all depends on what you need to know. And as I try to explain what that means in a sampling sense, I try to give you a sort of way that you can use it to better interpret the numbers. You know, people always ask me, how do you talk to, you know, 1,000 people? And that's representative of the world. So I try to explain in very, you know, straightforward terms how we put together those samples. I think when people see that and get a sense of why that all works, or how it works, then you'll have a better understanding of what's out there and also, you know, what it means and, frankly, what it doesn't mean.
So what it means, what it doesn't mean, when it comes to, and I guess this is somewhat of an ethical question, but what if it impacts someone, and I know you have no control over this, but what if it has an impact over whether a person goes to the polls or not? I mean, do you think polling has any impact if somebody is seen as a clear favorite and other people say, well, all right, this is my candidate and they're obviously going to win, or this isn't my candidate, so what good is it? Do you think it has an impact on people getting out to vote?
Well, I have seen studies that go either way. Most of the folks vote because they're either interested in their candidates or they are interested in politics, and they do it out of habit. So, but there is talk out there that if people feel like a race is a foregone conclusion, then they may or may not be, that might help change their voting decision. But here again, I think it goes back to the idea of, do you go beyond the horse race and say things could change? Do you assume that just because a race or a contest stands on as it does on one day, that that's not going to be different? And I think that part is the one of the things we need to combat. Let me linger on that idea of horse race for a moment. We use the term, I think, too much, because it's really an inapt analogy. You're talking about in a horse race, as the horses run, the course gets shorter. Things are gone and never to return. It's over. But an election, it is a campaign, is a collective decision that takes place either on one day or in the span of a few days of early voting. And everything could change tomorrow. And so, you're not tallying points along the way as you go. And I worry sometimes that if we make just too much of that, just that horse race number, it feels like that. It can feel like, oh, those points are tallied, therefore everything's over, when in fact, as we have seen and seen many times, things can change. And I don't say that as a hedge on the polls. I say that as something that I think is exciting and dynamic. It means that people are having an argument. It means that campaigns are out there trying to persuade people. And isn't that ultimately what democracy is all about?
Anthony Salvanto is CBS News' Elections and Surveys Director. He is also the author of the new book, Where Did You Get This Number? A Pollster's Guide to Making Sense of the World. Anthony, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Where Did You Get This Number? A Pollster's Guide to Making Sense of the World. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.